You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we are talking historical fiction with three Brighton and Sussex-based authors. We take you from post-World War II Italy to Victorian Brighton and to a reimagining of Virginia Woolf's Lewis in the 1900s. We discuss everything from the research process to unearthing secrets and to getting the details right. The show is also available as a podcast, which you can download wherever you get yours. And if you like and enjoy it, do give us a rating and tell your book-loving friends. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. Italy, 1949. At an orphanage in the poverty-stricken Apennine Mountains, 15-year-old Adelina has only one younger friend, enigmatic, fragile Elisabetta. When Elisabetta claims to see the Madonna by the river, Adelina has doubts. But after Elisabetta appears to heal Giulio, an injured and traumatized young soldier, crowds flock to witness the mystery of Elisabetta's miracles. Adelina can no longer contain her misgivings and seeks out scheming priest Padre Bosco. As the secrets of the past begin to unravel, Adelina, Elisabetta, and Giulio each have to confront who or what to believe. Soon they face a terrible reckoning, which will cause deep ripples in all their lives, reaching across the years to 1990s England. Anna Lucia, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be speaking to another literary Anna about all things writing.
Anna, can you talk about the inspiration behind Broken Madonna?
Maybe if I sort of start talking a little bit about the place and the time, because that's what's really at the heart of this novel. So the place, it's the Apennine Mountains, which is in the stretch between Rome and Naples, a lovely little place called Atina, which is well off the tourist track, but it's the place where all my ancestors come from. So it's, I am 100% Italian by blood. And when I was a child, both my parents came to England in the 50s. And as a child, I used to go to Italy an awful lot. And there was something about the river, the mountains, and that sense that this is absolutely where I come from, that I wanted to capture in writing somehow. And it's a sort of, it's the sort of place that isn't, and this way of life, which I'll talk about a little bit more in terms of inspiration, that you just don't read about in English literature. So that was something I wanted to do. So the time is post-war Italy. So Italy was enthralled to Mussolini, obviously, for a long time. They swapped sides during the war. So Italy comes out of the Second World War as a country that's gone through a lot of trauma and a lot of soul searching and is trying to find its place. So I felt this sort of combination of a really beautiful place, a country in trauma, looking for sort of a way, you know, what does the future look like? But a country where religion also has a big sway on people's lives. And I wanted to capture something about lives, you know, ordinary lives that have had, you know, quite tough, but people with tough backgrounds, and really represent these kind of the dilemmas that religion, politics, societal sort of mores, kind of how they affect people's lives. So those were some of the initial influences. And the other thing, I guess, was some of the themes that Broken Madonna touches on. So I'm really interested in life. I have a background as a counsellor and a coach and a mentor, mental health generally. I'm really interested in what people choose to believe in life and what they act on. And I've worked in the Catholic Church. I'm not a practicing Catholic now, but I've got a real fascination with the kind of stories of young female mystics and visionaries in particular. So lots of people know, obviously, about Bernadette of Lourdes and Lourdes being a place of pilgrimage. But I was just fascinated by the fact that there are a lot of, you know, all of these, a lot of the visions seem to come from young girls. And it's kind of about that time in of life around puberty, for young girls and women. I was really interested in what's going on, what do people believe in, and then really, and I guess what goes into me as well is that whole thing about what we carry through the generations in terms of both positives, you know, truth, compassion, that's the study of epigenetics, but also trauma as well. So I wanted to see if you could bring together a story that was about the backdrop of a really sort of sweeping times, big changes in society, but also about ordinary lives and how they're touched by religion and all of those issues. So I hope that kind of gives you an idea of some of the inspiration behind Broken Madonna.
It absolutely does. I'd love to know a bit about the research process. We're really focusing on historical fiction in this episode of the Brighton Book Club, and I'm really fascinated to know how you even start getting to the bottom of the facts behind this story.
So for me, there was a little bit about lived experience almost in my family about who had gone through this time in Italy. So when I was young and I used to go on these visits to Italy, and it was very long, hot summers spent with a lot of older women who would tell me these incredible stories about, you know, how life was and how it was lived. So there was a little bit of that. But I've traveled quite extensively in Italy. I've looked at buildings that kind of find their way very much into the book in terms of, so for example, Elisabetta and Adelina are in the orphanage. That orphanage comes from a mishmash of places that I've visited in the past. Giulio, who is the character who's healed by Elisabetta, who's had a very traumatic past, he finds solace in the orphanage garden. I went to a beautiful monastery in northern Italy with a wonderful garden that I could just see somebody like Giulio finding his healing space in. So that kind of found its way a little bit into my book. I guess I'm a bit of a magpie really in terms of finding sources of inspiration. So I spent quite a long time looking at stories of female visions and female sort of, because I've got a character, Sister Beatrice, in the book, who's a young kind of nun in the late 40s in Italy, who she heads up the orphanage, and she's the person that Elisabetta goes to with her visions. There was a time of kind of quite a lot of renaissance in the church at that time, where women thought they could have a much bigger role in how things would shape up. And so I was quite interested in that. So I did some looking into that at Heythrop College at the University of London, the Italian Cultural Institute. And then there's another sort of research kind of bit that really fascinated me. There's a lady in Italy called Angela Volpini, who is still alive today. And she had visions of the Virgin Mary as a child through to her teenage years, and she heads up a foundation in Italy still that many people still follow. So, you know, there's a kind of a drawing in of lots of different sources in terms of inspiration and research.
This feels like the perfect time for us to hear an extract. Please, can you read us some?
Of course. So this is Broken Madonna by Anna Lucia. Prologue. 22nd of June, 1938, River Molarino, Apennine Mountains, Italy. Forgive me, Puccina mia, little one. Icy water rises up and grabs at the woman's stretched, empty belly. In the makeshift sling, her newborn baby wails, strong fists and feet against her mother's swollen breasts. The baby opens her pale blue eyes, eyes that belong to a much older soul, and looks up. The woman presses her pockets, feeling the weight of the pebbles, and she lifts her hand towards her child's face. Her fingertips hesitate on the baby's soft skin, the dimple on her right cheek. She can't do it. Her hands plunge back into the water and she tears at her pockets. The stones are too heavy. The river pounds downstream, glistening in the moonlight, and swallows the wretched cries from the baby's tiny body. As the woman tries to edge backwards, her feet struggle on the slippery riverbed. Almost safe, tesoro, she lies, as the baby lets out a terrified cry. A wave hits the woman's side. All at once, they're sucked down deep into the water. No, no, per l'amore di Dio, no! The sling is unraveling. The woman kicks with all her strength, but the water pulls her this way and that. Her back strikes a boulder hard. Suddenly, her head breaks the surface of the water. She's gasping for breath, the sling clutched tight in her hand, but there's no weight to it. Elisabetta! Her scream echoes across the valley. The water is dragging her back into its cold embrace as she hears a voice. A young man crying out, thrashing in the water nearby. Just before she disappears, she sees her child in his arms.
Anna, that is such a powerful opening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
How does it feel kind of reading it out loud?
It's really interesting because I really want to kind of try and get into character with how the mother, who it is later revealed in the book, obviously who the mother is, but also this kind of whole feeling of how, what it must be like to be in a situation where you feel you have no choice left to you, that you would consider taking that, you know, making that decision to walk into a river and do that to yourself and your child must be pretty desperate. So I don't know if I do the words justice, but I hope that that comes across, that sort of real sort of like, actually, this is something really deep and meaningful right at the beginning of the book, and a mystery that, you know, is obviously goes a long way back into the past as well. So
absolutely. Well, I thought that was wonderful. So, Anna, you decided to self-publish Broken Madonna. Can you talk a bit about this decision and how you found this whole process?
Well, Broken Madonna is the second novel I've written. I did try the traditional publishing route and I got sort of, you know, so far I got, you know, moments where you think, oh yeah, this is really going to happen. And then no. So I knew as a result of that, that the quality of my writing was there, but it just hadn't landed on with the right person. And I really thought to myself, I want to get my words out there. I think there are people who will enjoy reading this. So I decided to go down the self-publishing route. And I'm really pleased that I have done so. I've enlisted the help of various professionals along the way. So I've had a great professional cover designer who's really captured the spirit of Broken Madonna in the cover with a wonderful picture of a young girl that represents Elisabetta. And the sort of scene of what Italy looks like. So, and I've had some help in terms of the typesetting and the formatting. So the thing with self-publishing, obviously there's a lot of micro decisions that you need to make, but I have worked for myself for a long time now. So I'm used to kind of having to work things out for myself and pulling in help where you need it and thinking who's best positioned to do this for me. And, you know, how to bring together a supportive team around me, because although it's self-publishing, you don't do it entirely on your own. If you're going to do it successfully, in my view anyway, you draw on people who've done it before and who have experience to offer you. I mean, it's been a huge learning curve. I know it's not for everyone, but I launched in the middle of November. And I've been really pleased with the process. And I got my first printed copies yesterday, and the cover and everything, it just looks really super. And I'm just so super proud of myself.
Oh, it's such a big achievement and a completely new discipline.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think, but it is something that you can learn. You know, I think it does take a certain mindset. I know a lot of people are put off by, you know, all the things you have to learn. You have to learn everything from, you know, sort of how to format a book, the distribution channels for a book, how to market it. There's a lot in there. But I think these days authors are being asked to do that a lot more, even when they're traditionally published. And so, you know, I think they're the skills that you do need to learn to be a thriving writer, essentially. So I think, you know, I just see it as a great way to learn and to push yourself a little bit outside your comfort zone and, you know, just enjoy the process, really. And that was the thing, at the heart of it, I wanted at the beginning, I thought my words deserve a place in the world. And I want to treat this as an adventure. And I want to, when I launch it, I want to be completely proud of every aspect that went into it, not just the writing of it, all of it, really. So yeah, I think, you know, as I say, it's not for everyone. I can understand that, you know, if some people would find it just too time consuming, which it certainly is, there's no denying that. But I think there's a great deal of satisfaction and pleasure to be gained from, you know, sort of making those decisions about the cover, how you're going to format it. Are you putting it across? You know, have you pitched it in the way that you think will be appeal to the people who are potentially your readers? So there's a lot of creativity in that process, which is very different from the writing process, but I think they're quite complementary, really.
Absolutely. Anna, how do you find being a writer in Brighton? You've been here a long time now.
I have. I've lived in Brighton for 25 years now. And I think it's absolutely the best place to be a writer because we've got a naturally very creative community, not just in terms of writing, but in more broadly across the arts. And my way into writing came originally via New Writing South, which is the literature development agency for the southeast of England. So I'm trying to think when it would be, probably about 10, 12 years ago, something like that. I did a short fiction course with New Writing South. And as a result of that, I started to kind of get to know other writers. And then I entered a competition that New Writing South were doing to kind of help talented and emerging writers, which was called the NWS 10, where they helped mentor writers who showed promise. And through that, I got support via the Arts Council as well. So if it wasn't for being a writer in Brighton with New Writing South and having that community, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you today. So I think it's gone full circle now. So the bit that you and I share is that obviously I'm now chair of trustees of New Writing South. So I feel as if I want to give back some of that support that I've received and really be there to champion writers of all types of backgrounds, but particularly those people who don't traditionally have a voice in the industry. And I think it's a lot about breaking down barriers, because the publishing industry, you know, I've got a business background. I think people don't appreciate how tough it is to A, kind of get your voice heard, and then B, even, you know, try and make a living in this world. So I think, you know, creative voices are crucial to our, you know, our cultural life, our well-being. So it's something I'm really proud to be part of, to be chair of trustees of New Writing South. And I think it just, for me personally, it's about helping connect people as well. And, you know, just helping people feel that, yes, they have got a place in this community. And yes, their voice can be heard.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us. How can people find and follow you and get their hands on a copy of Broken Madonna?
So Broken Madonna is published on the 16th of November. It's currently available to pre-order via my website, which is annalucia.co.uk. And it's also available to pre-order on Amazon and via all good bookshops. But if you come via my website, you can get a signed copy with a personalised message from yours truly. And you can also find me on Instagram, author Anna Lucia, and on Twitter as well.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anna.
In the genteel squares of late Victorian Brighton, Ellen and Reynold Harper, twins, companions, colleagues, ply their trade as portrait photographers. But at the golden hour, the models arrive to pose for the lucrative and illicit photographs that really keep the Harper's business afloat. This is the other shadowy world of the city, a world of erotic tableau, boundary-crossing music hall performers, and the sinister figure of the local gangster, the Croc. When Ellen is drawn into the orbit of unhappy newlywed Clementine, she finds herself torn between loyalty to her brother, her dangerous attraction to new model Lily, and her burgeoning friendship with Clem. As the two worlds of Brighton collide, the three women discover that there is only a knife edge between the promise of freedom and the threat of ruin. Jackie Bluesy, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. It's wonderful to be here again.
So congratulations on the publication of The Secret Photographs. How did this fascinating idea come to you?
Well, I was looking around for ideas after I'd finished my first book, The French House, and I knew I wanted to write a book set in Victorian England and focusing on women's choices or lack of. And so I started doing some research into the period. And, you know, you don't have to sort of look very far before you come up with photography, and that, you know, photography was sort of invented pretty much in 1837 by Henry Fox Talbot. That was the first negative. And so I started thinking about photography, and I wanted to set it in sort of late Victorian England, where the whole world was on the cusp of change and things were changing very quickly. And in my research, I found, I was researching the cartoonist for Punch magazine, which was a satirical magazine, it's very popular at the time. And their lead cartoonist was a man called Linley Sambourne. And he lived in London, he was a bit of a character, and he was really interested in photography. So he was a keen amateur photographer. He had his own dark room set up in his house, and he often used to get members of his family to pose for him, sort of in outlandish poses that he would then copy for the magazine. And I was reading excerpts from his diaries, and it became clear that he also had a proclivity for photographing nude models, life models. So I got sort of quite interested in this, and it was all done, you know, quite surreptitiously, obviously. And then there were certain models that he used sort of over and again. And there was a footnote in these diaries about one of his favorite models. And I don't want to go into too many details because it's a spoiler for the book, but something happened to her. And it really made me think, you know, who were these women? What were their choices? Why were they doing what they did? And, you know, what were their stories? So that was the sort of the starting point for the secret photographs.
That's absolutely fascinating. What a great way to spark the idea. So once you'd found that footnote, mm-hmm. what did the research mm-hmm. process look like?
Well, there was lots of reading around the subject, and there were lots of different sort of strands to it, really. There's a lot of sort of research in this book that went into this book. So there was the photography itself and the sort of the photographic processes, dry plate photography and what that meant. I mean, that's the sort of the drier side of it, but also the whole kind of underworld of production and distribution of these erotic photographs that was really rife at the time. So I did a lot of internet research into that. I found out about a street in London called Holywell Street, which has since been destroyed, but it was a road that was just off the Strand, and it was full of bookshops. And there are often books that were very much sort of you know, under the counter books, and photographs were also available there too. So I did sort of research into places like that. I also I went to a lot of museums, and I found the Museum of the Hove Museum of Creativity really helpful for that Brighton flavor. So they've got lots of sort of fascinating material there, and there's a lantern show script about sort of Brighton itself, so which gives you loads of information in exactly the time I was writing about the pier and the what's going on sort of on the seafront, things to, you know, the Skylark boat that used to take people on little cruises around the bay. So yeah, I did sort of extensive research, really, in lots of different facets of the novel.
So we're going to move on to talk a bit about Victorian Brighton, because I'm so interested in that. But before we do that, can you read us an extract, please?
Yeah. So this is from the first chapter of The Secret Photographs. The band is midway through the Sailor's Hornpipe when Ellen Harper first sees the girl. She is sitting alone on a bench under the shelters, a half-eaten penny ice in one hand, the other pressed to her forehead in the manner of an old maid who cannot bear the Sunday afternoon rumpus on the pier and is somewhat regretting the tuppence she paid. but the girl is no old maid. Ellen sees this, and so does the young man, clean-shaven in a Homburg hat, who stops uninvited, casting her in shadow, and saying something that causes the girl to redden. She looks about her, skittish as a new foal. He lays a hand on her arm, and she shrinks back, and this last gesture, the audacity of it, is all it takes. Ellen Harper's feet are ahead of her mind, her boots click-clacking across the wooden boards, the surge of the sea beneath her, and applause for the hornpipe in her wake. The man eyes her warily, not brazen enough to brazen it out, a coward in his scuffed boots and cheap waistcoat with its gilt watch chain. He must sense the anger in her, for he mumbles good afternoon and slopes off into the crowd. I hope I wasn't interrupting. The girl looks up, a face like a heart and clear grey eyes that seem to incline more towards melancholy than merriment. Young, 17, I guess, with an older person's weariness about her. A straw hat bent a little out of shape, as if some younger sibling has jumped upon it, a stain or two on her gloves, a pale blue skirt with the colour leached from the hem through laundering. Although clean, her attire borders on shabby, too shabby to be in service in one of the squares. She is perhaps, and now Ellen is hopeful for her, an apprentice as a seamstress, somewhere that over time will pay enough for a hat with trimmings and lace gloves in the summer. No, miss, I didn't know him, nor wanted to neither, she adds, and she takes a spoonful of the melted chocolate ice and stares towards the silver horizon, just as the New Haven steamer passes with its muffled moan. I'd like to go where that one's going. The girl speaks softly with the air of someone unused to attention. France, you mean? She looks at Ellen with interest. Is that where it's off? It's the 3 o'clock from New Haven, I expect. Ellen finds herself sitting then, a handspan away from the girl. It'll be in Dieppe by tea time. Dieppe, her companion repeats tentatively, as if she has just been served up snails on a plate. And then, for Ellen, the smallest of smiles. Have you been there, miss? In passing. Only at night, though. Ellen laughs for no obvious reason and tells herself she really must go now, that this is time wasted and that the young ladies from the theatre, if one can call them such, will be squawking and twittering on their favourite table in the west-facing window of the refreshments room, and she has arrangements to make with them for tomorrow. But still, she lingers. I'm Lily, the young woman goes on, and a gloved hand is being held out for Ellen to take. Lily March. Miss Harper. For a moment, Lily's hand sits snug inside Ellen's own, as if it was fashioned to be there. A baby cries. The band starts up. Ellen's fingers slip free. Ellen waits until the band has played three more songs before she asks. By then, she knows Lily works with her mother and sister in a laundry, that she lives in the tenements in Albion Hill, that she has never left Brighton in all her 17 years, nor taken a dip in the sea. And that her pa, and here Lily's face flares a sudden angry red, her pa is in lockup for a year for doing something he shouldn't, and her Uncle Jack is down from Manchester to keep the house in order. He ain't much of an uncle, she says, her voice turned flat, no matter what her ma likes to think, and truth is, Lily can't bear him, and so she has decided. Decided? Ellen asks gently. To leave, Lily says with a sniff. For Worthing or Margate or... brightening a little, up north to Blackpool, for she's heard of the pleasure pier, all lit up electric, and she's sure the northerners' clothes must get just as filthy as theirs down here. She'll find a job in a laundry like the one she has now, except without her ma taking every last penny she earns. But first, you need money. A nod, a look of both wariness and hope. With a small thrill, Ellen realises she is the first person Lily has spoken to of this. She is a confidant. For my train fare and your first week of lodgings and a case for my things and a little extra for incidentals. Incidentals. Lily tries out the word and smiles. Yes. How delicious. The ripple of this exchange, Ellen thinks, this sharing of thoughts. And how fortunate that she is in a position to help someone who truly needs it. Miss March. Ellen lowers her voice and leans in towards her. How would you like to have your photograph taken?
Thank you so much, Jackie. Oh my gosh, you set the scene so beautifully, and your sense of, you know, your voice and the characters are really strong. When did these characters come to you? How did they form?
Well, the main character is Ellen, and as that excerpt showed, she works with her brother, and he's a photographer, and her role is to procure and find these new young women to come and have their photographs taken. And she was partly inspired, actually, at the time that I was writing, the Ghislaine Maxwell, the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who had just been in prison. Well, she was awaiting trial for her role in grooming young women to have sex with her partner, Jeffrey Epstein. And I mean, this was a very, you know, very sort of modern, very contemporary story, but it kind of fascinated me. And even though it was deeply disturbing, it made me sort of wonder about sort of, you know, why she did it, what was sort of going on there psychologically. And I think that sort of story fed into the character of Ellen, who is not in any way based on Ghislaine Maxwell, but is in a sort of a similar position in some ways. So it was an inspiration for the character of Ellen, and she is also a gay woman living at a time when there's no vocabulary to even sort of, you know, describe who she is and her feelings. So she's someone that has a, you know, is very conflicted in lots of ways. And she's also there trying to make a living for herself and for her brother. And she actually, at the start of the novel, she genuinely believes that she is helping young women like Lily, who, as we heard in that excerpt, is having a pretty awful time of it at home. And, you know, her driving aim is to leave her home and achieve some financial independence on her own.
Jackie, what can you tell us about late Victorian Brighton, which we probably won't know?
Well, I'm sure everyone listening to this who lives in Brighton and Sussex will know about, you know, the kind of the crazy Volks, Daddy Long Legs, which was this sort of train carriage that was on stilts that ran from from Brighton to Rottingdean. And if you didn't know about it, you do know about it now. And I'd really recommend Googling photos of that, because it's really quite something. But I suppose that sort of ties into just one of the things that sort of slightly surprised me when I started doing research was just, I mean, you know, if you go down to Brighton seafront now, pretty much any sort of sunny weekend, it's, you know, it's busy and it's packed and sort of all human life is there. But it was exactly, you know, it was the same but different in Victorian times, and it was absolutely just full of people, and not just you know, day trippers down sort of on the that come down on the train, but lots of itinerant tradespeople on the beaches. So there were lots of seaside photographers that were down there. There were, you know, people you wouldn't even think of. So like there were lots of chiropodists, because they were very popular in Victorian times. You know, you get these traveling chiropodists and you could go and have your feet sort of looked at on the beach. There were there was a stage set up by what they called then the Chain Pier, which is now our Palace Pier, where you would have Pieros were very popular at the time, so they would be performing. There were kind of all kinds of things going on the pier itself, and it was a lot more sort of free really in those days. There was a lot more variety, so people could go swimming there, they could go diving from a part of the pier, and they had very kind of curious exhibits on the pier itself. And towards the end of the 19th century, there were slot machines, and there were also one of the really odd things I uncovered where they had a flea fighting sort of cabinet where you could pay a penny and watch fleas fighting.
How bizarre and wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm going to do some Googling after this. So,
yeah.
Jackie, you're a writer in Brighton. How do you find how do you find being part of the scene here?
Oh, well, it's really, I mean, I moved here 4 years ago, and the first people I met actually were writers and booksellers in the local shops. We've got some beautiful independent bookshops in Brighton, and my local one is Kemp Town Bookshop. I'd like to give a shout out to them. So yeah, I found it really a really sort of warm and welcoming scene. I mean, there's just so many writers here, and it was great that earlier this year we had our first sort of inaugural commercial book festival that was set up by Davy Fennell called Beyond the Book, and that was a big success. I was lucky enough to be involved with some other historical fiction authors, and I believe there's another one going ahead next year in the spring. So, you know, it's a really, as you know, Anna, like, it's a very sort of lively, vibrant scene, isn't it? And it's very inclusive, and you know, it's a great place to be a writer.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jack. It's been a pleasure as ever. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of The Secret Photographs?
So The Secret Photographs is out on Thursday. So by the time this podcast has dropped, it should be fully available. It's available from Amazon. You can order it from your local bookshop or Waterstones. If you're Brighton based, if you pop into the Kemp Town Bookshop or City Books, they should have copies. And in terms of finding me, you can visit my website, which is jackiebluesy.com. And I'm also on Instagram. I can't quite remember what my handle is. It's something like JB Writer. That's right. And I'm also on Facebook.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
In the shadow of Lewes Castle lies buried an ancient tablet. Hours after discovering it, dashing local archaeologist Gideon Rivers is dead. Writer Virginia Woolf and her artist sister Vanessa both know firsthand that it doesn't take much to cause a stir in town. And when Gideon returned home from a dig in Syria with a glamorous Parisian heiress on his arm, all eyes were on him. But who could have inspired to murder such a charming young man? There are more suspects in his circle than it first seems. An ambitious fiancé, a jealous best friend, and a string of scorned former lovers. With the police chasing false leads and the murderer hunting down a second victim, one far closer to home, Ginny and Nessa are forced to take investigations into their own hands. Solving this mystery calls for a little creativity. This is book one in the Wolf and Bell Mysteries, a gripping new bookish cozy crime series for fans of The Three Dahlias, The Mitford Murders, and Golden Age Crime. Keir Byrne, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
When did the idea first come for you?
Well, in my day job, I write about gardening for various publications. And about 10 years ago, I went back to college to study horticulture. And following on from that, I wanted to get some hands-on experience. So I volunteered in the garden at Charleston Farmhouse, which is just down the road from me in Firle in East Sussex. And while I was there, some days the public would be wandering around the garden, but other days we would have the place to ourselves. And I think it was while I was there, kneeling down, weeding the borders, that I started to think what life must have been like when Vanessa Bell, who was Virginia Woolf's sister, was living there with Duncan Grant, who was her partner. They were artists, they painted together, but they did have a child together. So they did have an intimate relationship. And although he was predominantly gay, more interested in men. And I just became fascinated by the Bloomsbury set. And I'd studied English literature, so I already knew quite a bit about Virginia Woolf. And she also had a country house just down the road from me at Rodmell in East Sussex, Monk's House. So I think that got me thinking about the Bloomsbury set. And then I've always been a huge fan of Agatha Christie. I read, I think, all of her books when I was a teenager. And there was one day I was on a writing retreat in Yorkshire with Sophie Hannah, and three of us decided to go for a walk to the Bronte Parsonage. So it was a beautiful January day, But we got there and it was around the time of COVID and we hadn't booked tickets, so we weren't able to look around the house. We went into the shop instead and I noticed the Bronte Mysteries. And I think for the first time it occurred to me that you could have literary, real literary figures as detectives. And I put two and two together and thought, well, I know about the Bloomsbury set. Perhaps I could write something with them as detectives.
Now, I love the story behind how this book found a home. So A Deadly Discovery was pitched on Twitter. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And it was quite random, really. A writer friend from Sussex tweeted, and it was still just Twitter, it was just before it became X, that she was entering a Twitter pitch competition opened by Headline Accent, which is an imprint of Headline Books. So for one day, they were asking people to pitch their book in a tweet. And if they liked it, you emailed what you had to an editor. And so my tweet was liked. And I got in touch with the editor and said, well, I've only written 20,000 words of the book, but she said, send it anyway. So I sent it off and then didn't hear anything for several weeks. And then one Friday afternoon, out of the blue, I got an email with an offer for two books, which was amazing. And just goes to show that there's many different routes to becoming an author these days.
Absolutely. So before we hear an extract, I'd love to hear a bit about your research process. What archives did you dig into?
Well, for me, I think actually being in the places is the most important research. So obviously I was in the garden at Charleston. I can easily get down to Monk's House, which I love, and wander around the rooms there, which are just beautiful. And also walking around Lewes, my hometown. So a lot of the novel is set in Lewes. It's a very historic town full of Twittons, which is the Sussex word for pathways. And we have Lewes Castle in the centre of town, which is very central to my novel. So a lot of it was just wandering around. I'd done quite a lot of historical research into Lewes Castle and the archaeology of this area for another unpublished novel. So that makes an appearance in my novel. And then when it came to Virginia and Vanessa, I read the autobiographies. There's an amazing autobiography of Vanessa Bell by Frances Spaulding, and Hermione Lee, who's one of the great biographers, wrote a biography of Virginia. I absolutely love Virginia Woolf's diaries. I think if you don't get on with her novels, her diaries show a completely different side to her, and they're really chatty and vivacious. And I've read books by Nigel Nicholson, who's written a really good short biography of Virginia Woolf. So just sort of reading around them generally.
Can we hear an excerpt, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to read from the second chapter of A Deadly Discovery, which is when we first meet Virginia, or Ginny. Lewes, East Sussex, Saturday, the 6th of October, 1928. Get a move on, shouted a ruddy-faced man leaning out of the window of a dust-covered coal van. He revved his engine too close behind them as Leonard struggled to make a hill start. The roads in Lewes were awfully steep, and her mild-mannered husband was still trying to get to grips with their new automobile, a second-hand Singer. They really ought to get a chauffeur, but money was tight, and they simply couldn't afford one unless the book she'd just published sold twice as many copies as the last. It was a risk, as she didn't know whether her readers would take to the whimsical tale of a cross-dressing Elizabethan aristocrat. The essay on which she was working, about how a woman needed financial independence and a space of her own in which to write, certainly wasn't going to cover the cost of a driver. She was due to deliver it to two women's colleges at Cambridge later that month, and expected to be repaid only with a homely meal of beef, greens and potatoes. If she were lucky, it might be followed by prunes and custard washed down with water. Leonard, bless him, remained unflustered and tried the engine once more. This time it stuttered into life, and, not wanting to lose momentum, he swung the vehicle sharply round the corner onto the high street, sending the riders on horseback gathered outside the White Hart scattering. With a groan, she realised they'd chosen to come into town on the same day the Lewis Hunt had its monthly meet. "Mind that dog," she yelled, as Leonard narrowly avoided running over a beagle. He pulled the car to a halt outside the hotel. Glancing in the rearview mirror and tucking a strand of greying hair into her tweed hat, Ginny turned the handle and climbed out, feeling the stiffness in her bones. "Do you want me to pick you up in an hour?" Leonard called after her. "Certainly not. I'll walk back to Rodmell. Altogether more civilised," she said, adding, "Enjoy your morning with the nursery man." Leonard was taking the car onto a plant nursery out near Ringmer, where he was planning to buy herbaceous perennials for a new border he was digging in their garden at Monk's House. "Ginny!" At the sound of the name used only by family and close friends, she turned round to see her sister had just arrived. "Good. We can go in together. I do so hate being kept waiting for breakfast. Nessa, what on earth are you wearing?" Her sister was clad in a large flowing item of clothing. If Ginny had to give it a name, she supposed it would be called a smock. It was made of rough brown linen, covered in smears of earth and moss, and looked suspiciously as though it were being held together by safety pins. "I was up early painting the garden this morning. It's so very beautiful in the autumn light. Then I realised I didn't have time to change if I wanted to make it into Lewis for the market. They sell out of the good stuff so quickly," said Nessa. On her arm, Nessa carried a wicker basket laden with potatoes, a couple of rabbits and a pheasant she'd bought from the game stall. She grew most of the vegetables she needed in the kitchen garden at Charleston, the farmhouse she rented nearby with her close friend and painting partner, Duncan Grant. "Come on then, although I shan't be surprised if they ask you to come in via the tradesman's entrance," said Ginny. They pushed through the double-fronted doors into the foyer of the White Hart. A smartly dressed man behind reception looked at them a little strangely. "Breakfast for two," said Ginny. It was a statement rather than a request. "This way, ladies," he said, showing them into the dining room, which was already half filled with red-coated huntsmen, farmers and their wives, sleek, rosy-cheeked businessmen with hands placed over their substantial middles, and silver-haired ladies dressed in their finest for market day. He showed them to a table near the window looking out onto the street. Ignoring the disapproving looks inspired by her outlandish appearance, Nessa tucked her basket out of the way. "Would you like to see a menu?" asked a mousy-haired waitress, who looked as though she should still be at school. Ginny shook her head. She knew exactly what she wanted, had been thinking about it the whole way here, as the automobile bumped over the potholed roads. "Kippers, with coffee to wash them down. No milk," she instructed. "And for you, madam?" the girl asked Nessa, who smiled sweetly. "Hot buttered toast, please, with plenty of milky tea." The waitress grinned. "That sounds like my kind of breakfast," she said. Ginny scowled, but before she could think of a retort, she was interrupted by a booming voice on a cloud of perfume and pearls. "Mrs. Wolfe, what an unexpected pleasure to find you here." Looking up, she saw Mrs. Rivers, who lived in Hollybush House, one of the grander houses in Rodmell, and was constantly thrilled to have a well-known writer for a neighbour. She rose ever so slightly from her chair, just the degree required for politeness. Daphne Rivers was powerful in the village, and it wouldn't do to get on the wrong side of her.
Thank you so much, Keir. That sets such a beautiful scene of the book. Now, it's not a small feat to write about the Woolf sisters. You know, Virginia Woolf is arguably one of the most famous female writers of all time. What did you discover about them in the writing process?
So it's a really strange thing. I know that everyone's meant to be afraid of Virginia Woolf, but I didn't find that at all. I have quite a clear feeling about them as individuals, as real people. Obviously, that's completely my imagination. But I think sort of through reading their history and through reading the diaries, I like to think about what they would have been like as people. And one thing that occurred to me was that they'd had a lot of grief in their lives. So they lost their mother when Virginia was just 13 and Vanessa was a couple of years older, which was very traumatic, clearly. And then their half-sister, Stella Duckworth, stepped into a motherly role. And then she died during pregnancy quite unexpectedly. So they lost her. Then they were very close to their two brothers. They had two half-brothers who were not so nice, but they had two full brothers, Toby and Adrian, and they were very close. And they went on holiday to Greece together when they were all in their 20s. And Toby, and I think Vanessa as well, contracted typhoid fever. And incredibly sadly, Toby died at the age of 26. So I feel that they had all this really early sadness in their lives. And for me, that was why, although this is meant to be quite a light-hearted, cozy crime, when they are confronted with the death of a young man who reminds them of their brother and is a similar age to Toby when he died, they feel they really need to find out who the murderer was to sort of for him, really.
That's so interesting to really kind of go into the psychology of these real people who we obviously don't have any direct access to. It's really brave, Keir.
It's funny. I mean, it didn't feel brave. I think that's the thing about being a writer. These ideas occur to you and, you know, I just find myself thinking about them. It's an amazing process. And, you know, maybe some people might think I've taken liberties by writing about real people, but I just love imagining them and bringing them to life in my mind.
So you are working currently on the second book in the series. How are you finding this?
So book two is actually pretty much written. It's in the copy edit stage. So it's already been through a couple of rounds of edits. So I wrote both books quite quickly. And I'm very excited about book two. It's also set in Sussex, but in a slightly different part of Sussex. And there are some of the same characters. I have a real policeman in my books, as well as Virginia and Vanessa. And he is called Inspector Arthur Gripe. And he's actually inspired by somebody who used to live in my house. So I live in an Edwardian house in Lewes. And the first owner of our house was called Arthur Vine. And he was a superintendent or deputy superintendent of Sussex Police. So I took him and then sort of using that as a base, created my own fictional policeman who is Chief Inspector Arthur Gripe.
That is so imaginative. I am very impressed. So, Keir, you're a writer in Brighton/Sussex. How do you find being part of the scene?
I think there's an amazing writers scene around here, and I feel so blessed to have some really good writer friends. I have you to thank for that. I came along to your West Hill Writers Group, and that was just a fantastic experience and really helped to hone my writing and at the same time meet other writers and talk about writing with them and come along to writing retreats. And I'm still in touch with and friends with many of those writers, and some of them we still meet up and read our work to one another, send one another our work to be first readers, which is amazing. And then also through you, I came along to the launch of your little book of Ick, mm-hmm. and met the wonderful Cindy Etherington and Victoria Robson. And they set up the Real Writers Circle in Brighton, which has been another brilliant group. They host monthly meetings where people go along and do readings and talk about the business of writing and the act of writing. So there's a very vibrant scene around here, and obviously also the amazing festivals we have. I know you've got your festival coming up, The Coast is Queer. So all of that just goes to a really supportive atmosphere.
Absolutely. Well, I would just like to make an announcement that I didn't pay Keir to say any of that. Thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you, and where can we get our hands on a copy of A Deadly Discovery?
Well, the book is for sale at some independent bookshops and also on Amazon and Waterstones. If you prefer listening to books, there's a brilliant Audible reading by Jilly Bond, who's an amazing actress. It's on Kindle, so all of those places. But I do, if you can get a paperback copy, and it's a paperback original, there's a beautiful cover design by Amy Cox. She's very talented. And you can find me on Twitter at Kia Byrne, which is C-I-A-R-B-Y-R-N-E, on Instagram at Kia Byrne Writer, and on Facebook at Kia Byrne Author.
Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with book two.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you for listening. If you are a podcast listener, you can subscribe to the Brighton Book Club podcast for extra content and our back catalogue of almost 100 episodes. Links to Anna, Jackie and Kier's books are in the show notes, and more details are over on Instagram at BTM Book Club. If you have an idea for the show for 2025, you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. We will be back next month with our Christmas recommendation special with owner of Kemptown Books, Kathy Haywood, who will also be talking about her new book, The Secret of Brighton House. We'll see you next month. Precious.